Meeting reconvene at 7:19.
Okay, we're gonna call this meeting back to order. And we're back to the original question. Looking for a nomination for the candidate from Ward 2. Councilor White, what's your nomination?
Teresa.
You got a nomination of Teresa DeWalt. Looking for a second.
I'll second that.
I have a motion and a second. Any further discussion?
I make a motion for Laura Duncan.
We have to vote on the motion already. Already before the council.
Sorry about that.
So I'm asking for a vote for Teresa DeWalt. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Nay.
Okay, I have three ayes and a nay. The motion carries. Teresa DeWalt is the new council.
Well, thank you.
Congratulations.
Be careful what you wish for.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a very new.
You're welcome.
No, it's a good thing.
Okay, do you have your bow? You want to do your thing?
Yeah, we still find out, but look, you did.
Yeah, there we go.
Once again, you got the way you wish for.
Thank you. The over.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Sorry, he's gonna want you down here.
Oh, okay, so I have to sit?
Yeah.
Right here is okay?
Yep, that's fine.
It looks like I'm gonna have to bring somebody over right here.
Yeah, I know.
Okay.
Well, it's okay.
That's a challenge. I like it.
Do the oath.
Teresa, step up here.
Who's got a camera?
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Are you prepared to take your oath of office?
I am, yes.
Okay, raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, Teresa DeWalt.
I, Teresa DeWalt.
Do solemnly swear that I will support the Constitution of the United States of America.
Do solemnly swear that I will support the Constitution of the United States of America.
The Constitution of the State of Oregon.
The Constitution of the State of Oregon.
And the laws thereof.
And the laws thereof.
And the ordinances of the City of Winston.
And the ordinances of the City of Winston.
And that I will perform the duties of counselor.
And I will perform the duties of counselor.
To the best of my ability.
To the best of my ability.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, now you're stepping into a...
I'll get you a name and place next there. I don't know what I'm doing.
Can you get five?
Yes, of course.
All right.
Do we have two of them?
Put your right to work, huh? No, I thought about... Sure have that before the end of the meeting.
Copy for our records and return this to you.
Thank you very much.
It's still pretty fresh in my mind. I just did...
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Mr. Bauer, is Teresa's packet complete in the book?
I believe it is.
Okay. At this point in time, we're going to enter into a public hearing of the legislative amendments to the land use and development ordinances, LUDO. City of Winston Council will conduct a legislative public hearing to consider proposed legislative amendments to the Winston Zoning Ordinance, Subdivision Ordinance, and Comprehensive Plan. To ensure that these proceedings are conducted in a fair and orderly manner, state law has established rules and procedures governing the conduct of land use hearings. I will now explain the procedures we will follow. The hearing will be conducted in the following order of events. A list of those interested in speaking will be obtained. The Winston City Council will then hear the written staff report. After that, public testimony will be taken. I want to stress that all testimony, including rebuttal, will be directed to the Winston City Council. The Direct exchanges between opposing parties will not be allowed during the hearing. The hearing will then be closed and discussion limited to members of the Winston City Council and staff. A recommendation from the Winston Planning Commission has been made and the final action toward adoption will be taken by the City Council following a hearing to adopt an ordinance for the proposed legislative amendment. Does everyone understand the hearing procedures as I have described them? Please note that these hearings are being tape recorded. This is to provide a full record of the hearing, so it is important that only one person speak at a time and only after being recognized. After you have been recognized, please begin by clearly stating your name and residence address for the record. I will now open the legislative public hearing to consider proposed legislative amendments to the Winston Zoning Ordinance and Winston Subdivision Ordinance and the Comprehensive Plan. Announce the fall. Okay. If anyone in the audience believes this item should be heard as a quasi-judicial matter rather than as a legislative matter, now is the time to address your concerns to the commission. We will now establish for the record those persons who wish to speak at this hearing. Mr. Bauer, at this point, do we recognize Mariah and Thomas?
Your Honor, Mariah and Thomas are staff, so they will be providing the staff report, and I don't know if there are anyone on the phone who wants to be a qualified speaker.
Is there anyone present who wishes to speak on the legislative proposal? That includes y'all on the phone. Has staff received any written comments on this proposal?
No, Mr. Mayor, aside from what we've had in the record since prior to the Planning Commission hearing from DLCD.
Thank you. The Winston City Council is concerned that this hearing be both fair and in substance and in appearance. Therefore, it is important that we establish for the record that all members of the council are able to hear and decide this request in a fair and objective manner. Do any members of the council have a financial interest on the amendments, which is the subject of this hearing? That would be a good time to say no.
No.
Do any members wish to disclose any facts which might create the appearance that they may have a conflict of interest or are otherwise unable to participate in this hearing in a fair and objective manner?
No.
Could be me, because I'm not sure exactly where the local flood areas are in the zones in the town here.
Then you wish to recuse yourself from the rest of these proceedings?
That's what I'm wondering if I should.
No. Counselor. They will be described to you in the staff report.
Okay.
Does any party have an objection to any member of the Winston City Council participating in this hearing? Now that the Winston City Council has been qualified, we will proceed to the hearing. Will the city planner please present the written report?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. Congratulations to a new member of council. We welcome you. You're in a good group of people. And members of the audience, this particular process has been a couple years in the running. So I want to extend a level of appreciation to our Winston Planning Commission. They've done a lot of work, and they've been very entrenched in this process, and we definitely appreciate them. So our final draft here that you hopefully you've had time to review. Obviously, it's a lot of material, so we won't go over every intricate part. But we will clarify that changes, we had a relatively low amount of them until about probably 6 or 7 months ago, and then we got a requirement from the state DLCD to adopt a new floodplain model ordinance, which essentially inflated our legislative amendments by quite a bit. So our packet is larger than it would have been otherwise. But we have three different areas that we're going to talk about today. The proposed amendments to the Winston Zoning Ordinance, Those include changes to accessory dwelling units, allowing them to be permitted uses in all residential zones that allow single-family dwellings outright. Adding the floodplain model ordinance and all of the changes that are incorporated therein. The proposed amendments to the Winston subdivision ordinance include adding language allowing the city to acquire a private inspection report for the installation of all infrastructure at the developer's expense. The proposed amendments to the Winston comprehensive plan include highlighting two areas inside the city limits or UGB of Winston that would be appropriate to add more industrial zoning if needed, and updating census and population growth numbers according to the recent census data and the Portland State University population growth analysis. So those are essentially what the amendments entail. For the record, we'd like to clarify that notice of the proposed amendments was mailed to the Department of Land Conservation Development prior to the Planning Commission hearing on October 7th, 2020, and that would be the required 35 days prior to that hearing on the 18th, that happened on December 18th, actually. Notice of the proposed legislative amendments was sent to interested individuals, agencies, utility providers on November 10th, and a legal notice was also sent. All of the regulatory requirements were followed in terms of a 10-day legal notice and a 10-day notice to the public prior to our meeting tonight, and we believe you got the staff report in sufficient time. So, starting off with our legislative amendments, the first few pages you're going to notice are clarifications on definitions. And again, the majority of them are going to entail the clarifications that DLCD wanted us to do in terms of the model floodplain ordinance. There's a lot of clarification to floodplain terms and definitions. Either we had to implement a new definition, for example, base flood elevation, or we had to beef up our existing one and make it more comprehensive. So the first few pages will encompass the clarifications on a lot of our definitions as it relates to the floodplain ordinance. There weren't any other definitions in section one that we addressed. Wasn't part of our original legislative amendment process. Starting on page 8, this is where it's gonna transition into folding in language to allow as a permitted use. Whenever you see a residential zone property, you are then allowed as a permitted use to do an accessory residential unit. So, for example, a guest home, a smaller accessory residential unit. A lot of people use it for family members, for immediate relatives. And this was a mandate by the state, by state legislation. And we were, all the jurisdictions in the state were required then to fold it into their local ordinance. And we're now accomplishing that a couple of years after the fact. So that the next few pages are going to be language, and you're not going to see really much changed other than the fact that we are adding in the permitted use section for the RLA zone, the RM zone, all of the zones that will allow a dwelling as a permitted use. We're adding as the last subsection accessory residential unit in conjunction with a single family dwelling or manufactured home. So that's essentially what that is. And then starting on page 13, and I think before I move on, page number 7 had a little error, a little typo that was brought to my attention. All the way at the top.
Page 7.
Sorry to go backwards here a little bit. So all the way at the top of page 7, you'll notice that red sentence, floodplain management regulation adopted by the city of ND. That's not an acronym. And we've scrubbed and scrubbed and scrubbed this, and we still find things. That's what this process is for. So we've noticed that and corrected it with the help of the mayor. So starting on page 13 is where you're really going to start seeing the nuts and bolts of the model floodplain ordinance that we had to address. So when DLCD came to us, we had two options. Option number one, which they would prefer this option, is to take their model ordinance and put it into our ordinance and completely get rid of our old one. The second choice was to compare the two and look at where our deficiencies were and then just supplement them, make the changes. We elected to do the latter because we had a lot of components that were in place. And we liked a lot of the language of our ordinance, and we wanted to keep some of those elements in place and just supplement the deficiencies and just fold in the language that was missing or beef up the language that they wanted us to do. So as a point of clarification, before we got the requirement by the state to beef up our floodplain ordinance, and the city manager is helping us with a floodplain map of the city, we were already addressing... Thank you.
You're a little short, dear.
It works. Yeah, so that's a good depiction of where our floodplain and regulatory floodway is in the city. As you can see, we're absolutely subject to it, especially...
So the pink areas is what we're worried about?
We're worried about all of it. These requirements are going to be, are going to address requirements for the blue and the pink.
Yeah, but the pink area is
the floodway.
The floodway.
The blue is the 100-year floodplain, and the yellow that you see not very much of, that's the 500-year floodplain.
Which is low hazard, which is essentially really no permitting process. The difference, as a point of clarification, is if someone comes down to get a permit and they're in the floodway, we're worried about not just protecting your structure you want to build from flooding in terms of elevating, building with flood-resistant materials, but we're worried about your development causing a rise in floodwaters downstream and making the flood worse in the event of a flood. So there's different requirements for both. Some additional thing.
Can we take a map first before you go
through? Oh, by all means. Yeah, absolutely. We can take a little pause if you want to take a look.
Hey, Thomas.
Yes.
What if there might be to address that not as anything against the ordinance itself?
Yes, thank you. Yeah.
Okay, so there's one right out here on Pepsi Way.
That's in the city, right?
That one's in the city.
Well, that one is in the city.
That one is in the city. Any permanent property has got to be out of the floodway.
Well, if he wants to go get his house, all right. Yeah, good.
I hear that from all.
Monkey, so there would just be.
Oh, yeah. Not monkey, it's monkey.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no.
So Mariah made a very good point. Just to clarify, nothing in regards to the map is changing, the floodplain map.
Thanks.
Yeah, we are essentially just altering and updating the language on how we facilitate permitting. And from a physicality standpoint, what we have to make them do in order to meet the not just the National Flood Insurance Program's requirements, but what's housed in our local ordinance, making it consistent with what the state requires, but also locally what we should require in our community to keep us safe from flooding. So getting back to kind of some of the changes that we were going to make before the state came to us and wanted us to make these types of changes, what I was doing as the county floodplain administrator was looking at what's one area of the floodplain ordinance for Winston that we can really improve. Well, one thing we identified is that if you own a property and you're in the floodplain and you got a house and you want to do an accessory structure like a shop or something and you're in the floodplain, well, normally you have to bring your finished floor height up to at or above the base flood elevation. The base flood elevation is the level the water would be at in the event of a flood.
So if it's a pretty tall building,
and, yeah, and in some areas it's not inundated that much. You might see 2 or 3 feet. In other areas, we don't know that unless we get an elevation certificate from a surveyor or an engineer. They have to go out and run some levels, do the levels based on sea level. So we look at your grade and then where BFE is, and we make you raise your floor height. Well, there's a variance process. Sometimes you get activities or different types of operations on a property where it's not practical for them to drive their tractors up a ramp all the way into their, or cars or whatever it might be. So we have a variance to allow them to leave the finished floor height on the ground, and we make them put vents in, flood vents for entry and exit for floodwaters. And then you construct everything below BFE to have flood resistant materials. So that variance is available in a lot of jurisdictions, and it's a provision available through the state. But our Winston ordinance didn't have an option for it, which essentially means if you're looking at it from a straightforward aspect, that usually means you've adopted a higher standard. If it's not available in your code, that means you don't allow it. And we should allow it. It should be an option for folks to be able to do that.
Yeah, because we put those fans in when we built the house, which is back in 203.
It's required for houses anyway. So this is just relating to accessory structures. If we're talking about a house, your finished floor has to be elevated 1 foot above the base flood elevation. So that's a requirement. And then any area that's enclosed below BFE has to be flood resistant, and you have to have flood vents. And the requirement is 1 square inch per square foot of enclosed floor space. So it's a typical requirement. And so what we've done is we've identified the fact that the state, in their model ordinance, wanted us to do fold in a variance process too. So that was one of the bigger changes as it relates to the floodplain changes that we felt were advantageous. A lot of the other pages in here, and we can go through them, I'm happy to go through them, but they're essentially provisions that are here, but we added language to clarify what you're supposed to do. in terms of the permitting process.
If you're going through pages, I do have one question on page 27.
27, okay.
And that is dealing with recreational vehicles and campgrounds. We have three that's already in the floodplain. And it says that in here about 180-day maximum. And these three campgrounds, where a lot of people are permanent residents, that they're living in them full time, beyond 180 days. Is there a mandate or a federal, is that a state or a federal regulation that they have to move out after 180 days?
Well, there is also an ORS standard. I think it's 197.463. I think it's that. And the ORS standard says that if you have an approved RV park, you can't regulate the length of stay for an RV if you have an approved RV park. One of the things about RVs in the floodplain is that it's a preferable operation in the floodplain because they're not permanent. They have wheels on them. They're quick disconnect from utilities. So that's one of the things. But if we're taking this at face value, and we have our state NFIP coordinator and the guy that we work with for FEMA, Mitch Payne, and we've been facilitating an ongoing conversation. That's something we can bring up.
Yeah, the reason for that is that you got some that's on wheels, but doggone it, they've been there for so long, the tires have probably rotted off.
Right, yeah.
And they build up little things all around them, you know, et cetera, as a permanent resident. Mm-hmm. And that's in those parks.
Yeah, definitely a major concern. The length of stay gets tricky as it relates to the statute, and maybe Mark can clarify more on that, but go ahead.
I think what Councillor Kelly is trying to get to the bottom of is, do we have to allow that to continue as long as stay, or can we, because of these concerns, can we cut them off 180 days? In other words, force them to be portable.
And comes up to a question of potential liability for the city.
Yeah, it does. And if it's in the floodplain, then you have extra teeth. One of the things that this clarifies is that this comes from not just a state level, it's a FEMA, but it came from the Department of Land Conservation Development, but this is a model type ordinance that comes nationally through FEMA as well. They want most jurisdictions, because the NFIP program is a national program, so they're not anticipating additional state regulations.
Which would be the course of action for the city?
Well, you have a conflict with ORS 197, but I'll let him answer.
Let's clarify that. What the state statute says is that local governments cannot control length of stay. But it doesn't speak to the federal language that if you are in the floodplain, you're limited to only 180 days. Mm-hmm. So the way I read the ordinances, or the ORS, it says that in general, if you have an RV park, you can't do anything about it. Unless you go to federal regulation, which states in the floodplain, you can only be 180 days. So we will have to get an attorney involved in defining that for us. And I've already spoken with Mariah about this issue, and we plan to bring back information at a later date for you to consider.
Because that could be very much of a conundrum, because that's the only housing some people have.
Yes. That's right.
And at the same time, potentially puts the city in a state of liability.
Correct.
And we just have that revolving door syndrome from one RV park to another.
Right.
Just keep the ball in the air.
That's
true.
Yes, and the other unfortunate thing is there's no place for them to go.
Right.
There's just no available space.
My question, Mark, would be, how are we to know, as a city, how long a RV has been in a private park?
Well, we could start that tomorrow. You know, we don't need to go back and try and determine where they were before, but we could start. Let's just say that we researched this and council's given the authority to maximize their stays to 180 days, and what the process is, do they have to be away for a day, 2 days, 30 days? We don't know that information. So under the floodplain regulation. So once you have that information, at that point in time, you would notify your RV operators as to your the regulations they have to meet. You'd start at that point in time and start measuring forward.
My question would be, who enforces that? We're going to send Dana out to...
Yeah.
That would be enforced, yes, that would be enforced by code enforcement.
An even more important question to my mind, what that's worth, is how important is it for us to chase this particular monkey?
Thank you.
I mean, I don't...
There's no grandfather clause in that.
Yeah, but there's no real benefit for us to move people down the road.
And those are the decisions you as a council, if you want us to pursue this information for you, you would have to make based on the information that you've got. You may not be able to do it at all, number one. But number two, you know, if you could, would you even consider it?
Well, how much money do we want to spend chasing something that we don't have any ability to resolve? Mariah, please.
If you don't mind, I'd also like to contribute. The Code of Federal Regulations that stipulates 180-day stay also states that the RVs be road-ready, updated license and tags, no permanent structures affixed to them. And in some of the aforementioned RV parks that are common violators, you will see they have deflated tires, they have permanent decks that are built to them. I would argue that if we're going to make a case for going after RVs in these RV parks, it's really for public safety. We want to make sure that if there's a flood, they can get up and go, which is why they are commonly permitted in floodplains to begin with, because that's a good use of the property. RVs are ready. Again, if there's an emergency, they can leave at a moment's notice. Not really the case if they don't have to air in their tires, or if they need a big dually they don't actually own to tow their trailer out of there.
Exactly. That was a bigger question. Can they even move the darn thing?
Yeah.
I have a question for that, because if, like Mark said, not knowing how long they have to be gone, say it's a day or two, I don't know what it ends up being, but what's to say they don't just pull it down to somebody's parking lot, stay there for a day or two, and then go back to the park? I think that it's going to create more issues in the long run.
Well, that's how Andy gets his RVs.
My growing up in Portland, you saw this all the time. Yeah. They would tow it from one place to the next place, and then there's not a Walmart in sight that you can't go to and see RVs that are there for 3 or 4 days waiting to go to the next.
Now they don't even move them.
Now they don't even move them. Yes, yeah. You're exactly right. But I just don't want to see that in our community, yeah, when there's a park in a place that has other.
But the bottom line on this, too, is that we have to take a look. And I agree what you're saying, but it's a conundrum.
Yes.
Okay. Is that it's a matter of
the liability.
Of the liability. Yes. And the second part about it is, if we know that something is in violation and we do not act on it, that could be dangerous, yeah, too, for the city.
No, I agree.
The other thing on that is that if you have a place that has the garden is there, you know, the tires are flat, it's decaying, etc. If they move it out, they certainly don't want to move it back in again if they're going to have to move it back out.
Yeah,
again.
That's a possibility.
Well, a lot of those things have very particular age dates on those.
Yes.
And once they're there, they're fine, but after they leave, they don't get to come back.
Right.
Or if they go and move it, they may fall apart.
Well, the other thing that would happen would be if they moved out and it was a couple of days or so, someone else would move in.
Yeah.
Because there are people waiting to get into these as soon as the space opens up.
The other thing on this, too, please don't get me wrong when I say this, but is that indirectly, you know, we have the tourist tax that anything after 30 days,
yes, we don't get.
We don't get.
Yeah, right. That's true.
Okay.
And that's a problem.
That is a problem.
And that is that's a side of the ball on a coin.
Yes.
Dave, in rebuttal to that, it's how much do we spend and then get tourist tax back? Does it offset or does it outweigh?
Well, that's what you need to find out. How much we're going to spend, like I said earlier, on an attorney chasing something that we have no idea what the outcome is going to be. This could be a conversation for another time.
Could it not be under something that would be the park owner's responsibility to do to enforce and not the city?
we don't know that information without the city. The city is the ultimate.
You guys go with the attorney on that.
Yeah, the city is the ultimate permit.
Permitter.
So we would have the responsibility.
That doesn't cost us any money.
On enforcing our code.
What attorney, Tori?
The state.
The DA.
No, there's a state attorney that they said we could call if we had any questions, that he couldn't give us a permanent answer. Well, you probably already know that. To talk to him first and then bring it back, do we want to go further?
Right.
Whatever he says.
Yeah, I guess we're liable as the city for not holding the ordinance.
Yeah. And that doesn't cost us any money for that. When we go to our private attorney, yes, it does cost.
Yeah, we're kind of the regulatory body as it relates to that. And getting back to the 180 days, that is absolutely unequivocally part of the Code of Federal Regulations. It has to be in everybody who's adopted the NFIP program, you have to have that language in there, and that means you have the teeth to regulate it if it's in the floodplain. Is it normally regulated? Probably not too often.
And it has been in our regulations for quite a while. The only thing that's changing is just amending the text to make it clearer.
Mm-hmm. How do we justify all of a sudden deciding we're going to enforce a rule or a law that we've ignored for?
We have the reason right here.
Well, yeah.
The language has been updated.
Go ahead.
There are a lot of questions, and tonight we have a few answers for that. So I would recommend that we move on, and we will continue to do some due diligence on that subject.
Thank you for the question, Councillor Cunningham. That it does raise a good point of clarification. Kind of moving on, I'm on page 29. There's some language in here that, as it relates to garages or opportunate or accessory structures, we elected to use a lot of the new language. It was more clear and concise as it relates to if you want to build a attached garage or a detached accessory structure, including a garage. There are different rules. For example, if I have a house and I want to build an attached garage, the rules for elevating your finished floor height is anything below BFE has to be limited to vehicle parking, building access, and storage. Well, a garage is vehicle parking. So a garage, if you're attaching it to your house, immediately has a exemption to where you don't have to elevate the floor height. You want to have a situation where you can drive immediately into your garage and you don't have to drive up a ramp. It still would require flood vents and flood-resistant materials below BFE. So the language in there we felt was a major improvement with accessory structures as well. We talked some on that. So there's some language. If you have any questions on that, happy to clarify. On page 31, the regulatory floodway, some of the things that we did elect to add and kind of beef up as it relates to the language relates directly to different areas in the floodway. So I don't want to go too much into detail, but there are areas that there's not as much data. For example, we have these maps here delineating where the floodplain and the floodway is because FEMA did a lot of work, and they did what's called a HECRAS modeling that modeled the behavior of the flood and how the flood would act in terms of flow and frequency and all of those things. So when someone's in the floodway, they have to get an analysis to prove there won't be a detriment. And FEMA says, and our ordinance says, we use this modeling program to prove this, so you use it to disprove it on a specific site. So some areas, and I don't think that Winston has any, but some areas, we know there's a floodplain there, but there's no floodway delineated. There's a lack of data. There are areas of the county like that. So regardless if you have some of that in your city or not, there's language in your code that has to specify what you do when there's a lack of data. And if there was any of that area here on the map, you wouldn't see any pink. It would just all show up as blue. The cover, the river would be covered in blue as well, which indicates, hey, I'm dealing with a big patch of 100-year floodplain. It's just floodplain. When that's not exactly true, you have a lack of data. You don't have the robust modeling that FEMA did. And usually there's a couple reasons they did that. They didn't think there would be a lot of development in these areas, so the data stopped. Or you're getting way out in rural areas where there's less urbanization. I'm talking down by the fire area, Rock Creek. Once you get out far enough, the data is lacking. Another reason why you might see that is there might be a specific curvature in the river or the as it relates to the river, so the modeling didn't quite work as well. So there's a couple reasons, but we had to fold in some language for that. I don't want to confuse you too much, but we had to fold in some language to address that in the floodway section. But again, that part of it's going to be a non-issue because our entire city is delineated and has a floodway existing. So we know what to do. We tack on the higher floodway rules. Questions before we move on to the subdivision changes?
Just a very small point. When you say 100-year plain or 500-year plain, that doesn't mean that it's only happened once.
No, I actually despise that term. I don't even know
You're
who coined it.
One.
Yeah, I don't even know. So just to clarify, the blue is basically the 1% annual chance. That means you could go 4, 5, 6 years without it flooding at all, or you could have a 100-year event twice in a year. Essentially, we have 100 marbles, one's red. You pick one out, it's very random. It's 1% every year, 1% chance. The 500-year is a 0.02%. So maybe give you a ratio to better orchestrate that. Despise that term, Counselor.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah.
So the subdivision ordinance, there were very minor changes as it relates to, kind of what we did in the subdivision ordinance. We had the Public Works superintendent come to us a year or so ago, and we have an issue in the city as it relates to inspecting new developments. So if you get a subdivision approved and you go out and you need to put all your infrastructure in, streets, curbs, gutters, sidewalks, if you did it in, for example, a city like Roseburg, while you're doing that, their public works department will go out and inspect. They might have an engineer take a look to make sure that you're not going to build a, subgrade type of street. Like, we're looking at it, we know it meets the width requirements. We know the sidewalks all meet the, but in 5 years, is it going to start cracking? Is it?
Does it meet compaction?
Yeah. Does it meet the standards that we're looking for? So because Winston's dealing with a smaller public works crew, a rock solid one, but a smaller one, they don't necessarily have the staff to go out and do those types of inspections. So what we've done, which would be on page 37, is we folded in some language that would allow those inspections to happen at the developer's expense. We're not saying that condition has to be tacked on as it relates to a condition of approval for a subdivision, but we have the teeth there now to make sure that what they're installing meets the specifications of the city. So we feel like that's a good thing. Of course, whenever we do have a development of that kind of nature, we go through the proper procedures, and if Public Works feels by their own volition that we need to facilitate that requirement as a condition of approval, we're going to do it to make sure that we get infrastructure that's robust enough to meet the test of time. Questions on that?
The only question I have is why wouldn't we start implementing that? I mean, so with this language, it's capable, right?
Sure. Yeah, well, the requirement is there. That's a good question. One of the things I think that has made some people that read this a little nervous is, well, that's going to dissuade developers from wanting to do anything because then they're going to have to foot the bill for inspections, which isn't exactly, doesn't always happen in other cities, that might be bigger, but that's something that we would protest. Look, we're smaller in size. We don't have the staffing to go out and look at these things. So we want to pass it and make sure we're getting a good street for our citizens, good sidewalks, good storm, all that stuff. So I absolutely see it as a very good condition, but it's going to be a decision by Public Works and the city if that's a... usually when we do a subdivision or partition, we put out a notice and we would get a response from Public Works. If they say we need to, then we're going to require it. And that would be the process, as is typical in any division.
I guess, Andy, what would be the thing that would tip you off that it's not compacted right or in order to use this amendment?
Yeah, that, like I said, Thomas talked, that's something that Mark will kind of validate this section. That's one of the things that we've dealt with is we've allowed things to put in place.
Right.
And we've a lot of times never even witnessed it. So, you know, having the compaction testings, having the road inspected, having the sewer inspected to pass, you know, all the tests that we need to have done, are now the council's kind of seeing this fruition happen.
Yes.
We've been doing that the last few years now, and it's been working out a lot better than that direction.
So, for example, let's take a sewer project. You're not inspecting that. You're not running a camera through that sewer system after it's been installed. You don't know if that sewer system is laid properly on grade or whether it has bellies in it, which reduces the capacity, the overall capacity of that pipeline. That's one example of it. If you have a street installed and you don't get compaction reports on the base, the sub base, and the asphalt and the concrete, then you don't know whether or not that's going to meet its useful life or not. It's going to wear out too early. And we have all kinds of streets in town that have, you can see evidence of that clearly. So this is one of those things that, again, depending upon what the project is, it's certainly something we require on all of our projects. So you end up with a notebook like that has all the test reports, that were done, which has pictures of the installation, so we know it was installed. We know how many people were working on any given day during the project. So it's a lot of information, but when you go down the road 5 years, that's where you're gonna turn.
So are we requiring this type of information on subdivisions now then?
Yes, we will be requiring that.
Okay, good.
Okay. It's also, isn't it the same thing as the weight requirements for the weight of the vehicles that are allowed on the road?
Now, that's controlled by the state.
I mean, like, for instance, the side street thing.
But,
a big heavy truck.
For example, we design street systems, whether they're neighborhood collectors, minor arterials, or arterials. They're all designed under a standard engineering criteria, and so they are designed to meet weight loads of the types of vehicles that will be using that street system.
The reason I'm asking, like up, we have subdivision up by Safari, okay, and they're building up there, and they bring big loads of heavy gravel, dirt, I mean really heavy vehicles continually.
Right.
Yeah, would that not create then a road degradation?
If they were not constructed properly for those types of loads, yes, they're going to deteriorate quickly. And if you drive up there and look, they are, because nobody inspected those roads when they were being constructed. We just had a subdivider come in and say, "We're going to build this," and the city said, "Okay, go build it," and there was no inspections done by a city's, you know, neutral engineer to go up there and say, yes, this street segment meets the requirements of those kind of loads. There's other things that we can do. For example, what happens in a lot of subdivisions, they'll go in and they'll build the sidewalk and curb sections and street systems before they ever start on houses. Mm-hmm. Then the developer comes back in, the housing contractors come in, they cut sections out for driveway approaches. They drive their trucks back and forth over the sidewalk, and that tears your systems up. So, you know, those are some of the things that we want to look into getting into our codes to address some of the problems that we've seen within our street systems,
Edgewood,
especially
Edgewood,
our
one of those streets, is it not?
Pardon me?
Edgewood, one of those streets?
Edgewood?
Edgewood, yes. So you got road rippling and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yes. And that's, you know, you expect to see some of that depending on the age of a system. But if that, let's just say Edgewood was only 5 years old and it's rippling like that, just like over in Looking Glass Estates, there's where you see there was no compaction testing on this system. We also know that some of the cul-de-sacs were not built to the proper diameter, so they were shortened, which makes it difficult to turn around a rig that's supposed to be able to turn around in them. So that all gets caught during inspection. And if you're not doing your inspections, then you're not going to see it until it's too late.
Is the classic on that because they put the sidewalks in and the streets in, and then they built the houses.
Right. Yep.
That's not just that unusual process.
No, it's not. But the idea is that they have to do the inspection.
Right. Okay, can we move along then?
Yep.
Moving along, the comprehensive plan changes, kind of going into those, which is the last part of it, the last changes that we've made. So the comprehensive plan is the raw data that we use in order to facilitate a lot of the requirements that are located in the land use development ordinance and the subdivision ordinance. So essentially what we started with was some language in the chapter one, which is the natural features. And you'll see that we added a policy, number six, wetland mitigation strategies to be implemented in sensitive areas. So this is comprehensive plan support in order for us to look at sensitive areas as it relates to wetlands in the city and address some of those issues in order to protect them. Now, keeping in mind, there are already state provisions in place that's governed and policed by the Department of State Lands. So whenever you're going to do something, development in a sensitive area like that, we have to notify DSL, and they may potentially need to do a DSL permit with the state and mitigation or avoid a wetland entirely. A lot of times, if it is a perceived wetland or a potential wetland, they have to do what's called a wetland delineation. We actually have a local wetland delineator here that moved in a year or two ago. He's got an office down just over from town. And so there would be some requirements tacked on, but we have some, we added some comprehensive plan policies here to help just kind of address protecting those sensitive areas.
Do we have much of that?
There is up north of town, northeast of Safari Estates, okay. Those types of areas. A lot of, I mean, some of it's inside city limits now. It is very sensitive in nature. And back when Safari Estates was being built out, when it was perceived to be an eight-phase subdivision, there's a lot of wetland mitigation that was required.
If you drive by the corner of Looking Glass and Brockway, and it would be the northeast corner, you'll see that there's one house that's right below the Safari Estates, and it sits in a on a large piece of property. What happened was the individual who bought it was planning to put five houses on that property. When his project went to state lands, they came back, said, we need to see it delineated. The wetland, does it make sure there's not wetlands on that area? And when they did that, it's like 80% of the lot came back as wet. So basically indicate he could build that one house. He may be able to shoehorn another one right next to that house on that section of Brockway, but he doesn't want to do that.
Yeah, so we've added some language there. We've also added a policy in goal D, Winston shall promote preservation and or usability of historic sites when deemed acceptable. Just to address, we do have obviously a couple of historical sites, so we have some language there. Once we get to goal F, the policies here, this would be an area of discussion. We've already struck out some the last sentence of policy two as it relates to identifying, or the purpose of this review and approval process is to identify and minimize potential adverse impacts to the wildlife safari resulting from development in these areas. So we've struck that out because we feel that the point of the comprehensive plan is not to single out any kind of private entities, but to look at the overall needs of the city. And so that part of it. But this policy in its entirety, we feel with the help of some of other cities, including the mayor, we feel that this whole paragraph, we should probably readdress some of the language, the whole thing, and we will likely do that prior to our next.
So you're going to bring that back to us then at the next?
Yeah. We're going to come up with some new language for that whole area.
That's good.
It is important to maybe call out that we want to potentially identify and try to protect agricultural areas that might be located in the urban growth boundary as it relates to north of the city. I mean, those parts are important, but I can't see calling out anything additional to that as being imperative.
Right.
Happy to take any thoughts the council might have in that regard.
And this language was recommended by Planning Commission, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't anything that we discussed in depth, this policy too, at the Planning Commission level. So it was recommended that we approve this area. Moving on, the industrial opportunities area of the comprehensive plan, a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago, we had, during a city council meeting, a counselor who sits on the stand that recommended during the good of the order that we look at areas where we could identify where we can add in more light industrial zoning, which we immediately began looking around and where's an area that would be able to properly facilitate to that. And there are two properties that we identified. They are both to the west of the Douglas High School on Brockwood or 42, Highway 42. There's a 12.05 acre piece that's zoned special historical commercial, and there's another 3.73 acre piece that is zoned agricultural open space. These two areas, with the exception of the detriment of utilities, these two areas are spaced far enough apart from residential type designated lands. We feel that they're a good location. Just to reiterate the fact that this is an imperative, and we appreciate the volition of the specific counselor that put this in motion, there's only one industrial zone property, and it's the Pepsi plant that's in the UGB to the northeast. That's it. We don't have any inside the city limits. And so this will help to facilitate more opportunities for industrial type operations. So we have now laid the groundwork. Those specific properties, if they want to change to industrial, it would be a plan amendment zone change, and it would have to be triggered by those specific property owners. And so that's a quasi-judicial process. It would be a city process if we were taking one zone all in the city and changing all of them to industrial. That would be a city-triggered process. But since those specific properties, you know, that we're calling them out, then it would be a property owner-triggered process. That is the concluding materials. This relates to some of the research, Portland State University's Population Research Center. Just some updates there. There are some number disparities here and there, and we are, kind of calculating those. But there's a specific formula you have to follow. And something that we've shared is that planning staff has 20 hours a week, and we use a lot of that to facilitate to development. What we'd like to do, if we had more time, is do a complete overhaul of the comprehensive plan and update the whole thing. But we have went through and updated the numbers that we can right now.
So how do we
feel about increasing the time you spend in the city of Winston?
Renegotiate the contract, and from a contractual standpoint, we would just have to, and that would be a conversation between the city and the county, obviously, and my boss, Joshua Shackley, who's the planning director. I'm not going to speak for him, but I can say based on his mentality, he's always happy to have a conversation of that nature and to just kind of revisit those types of things. I can tell you that when I was here in the city, I didn't really care too much about the 20 hours. I loved working in the city, but the amount of work that we had, it was always 24, 26 hours. I mean, we were always going over. And I can't speak for Mariah because I just operate in a supervisory role overseeing it now, but go ahead. Okay. Yeah. We're re-looking at some of these numbers. We're going to make sure that they're tidied up.
Scribner's error.
Yeah, we'll make sure that they're tidied up prior to any kind of final adoption. But that would be the answer to your question there. And I'm happy to take any questions. I know that was a lot of information.
I see the population growth and forecast. How accurate is that for local?
That is just something that he brought up. Yeah, and one of the things, we're coming in at kind of an odd time, because when we did these, it was in 2018, okay. And the Portland State Research Center, which is what you have to use in the state, is just rolling out new numbers, okay. Even for the year. So,
plus we have the census numbers coming out.
Yeah.
It seems a little on the low side compared to, I've been here for 3 years, the growth that we're seeing in the community.
The growth numbers, I pasted the graph right in from the Portland State, and we're seeing, I think, a 1.8% increase every year. And the projection for 2065, as you'll notice there, is 11,095. What we would be doing, our numbers would be based on the 7560, because the comprehensive plan and the state rules only dictate that you have to have a 20-year projection. That's it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's a best guess scenario at best, and I do also believe that's a low number, but until we see the census data, and this is comparing a prior 20-year period that we had little or no growth for the first 10 years at least.
Things have changed. Things have changed. Positively.
Yes.
Okay, at this point, we need to ask if there's anybody else that wishes to speak and provide any written information on the subject.
Now you have to open the public hearing, Your Honor. And then ask for.
I already did that.
I will now open. Yeah, he did.
Oh, you opened the public hearing?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, so now you want to close the public hearing?
The next thing on the list was to ask that question. So, close the public hearing. Once the hearing is closed, no new testimony will be accepted. The City Council will not consider anything that is not part of the record. Does the Commission or staff have any questions for those who wish to speak?
No one spoke.
I will now close the hearing and begin discussion by the City Council. Do you have anything you want to say about this subject?
No, this was very comprehensive, so I appreciate Mariah Thomas's work on that.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, very well,
very informative.
You're welcome.
I think that the tidying up the language and stuff like that is actually just more than to you.
Perfect. Okay, let's get back to the council meeting. Consent agenda, approval of council minutes for January 19, 2021. Looking for a motion?
I make a motion that we approve the minutes.
A motion?
Second.
A motion and a second. All in favor of accepting the minutes for January 19, 2021, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Same sign. Thank you very much. Reappointments of various boards, commissioners, and committees. All at once, Mr. Bauer?
Yes, Your Honor.
Rob Price for the Planning Commission and Dave Carton to Urban Renewal Advisory Committee. Need a motion?
I make a motion that we select both two people for the appropriate positions.
I'll second that.
A motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Thank you very much. Comments from the audience. Anyone wishing to discuss items not covered on this agenda are welcome to address the city council as a whole. Please state your name and address for the record. Each speaker will be given a maximum of 3 minutes. Speakers may not defame, intimidate, or use profanity or personal affronts. The council reserves the right to delay action until they have full information on the issue. Anyone wishing to speak? Reports, boards, commissions, committees, and schools. Mr. Vandermark, what do you have to say?
So no new updates from the schools. I'm still going 2 days a week per each student. Again, on the respective dates, A through L on Mondays and Wednesdays, and Thursday on Tuesdays and Thursdays. The only other update I have about the schools so far is we're still in the process of the whole mural project and getting it relocated to what we feel is an acceptable location, and an open location that's visible to the public and to the students. And that's something we're currently kind of battling with the school board, is getting that final location authorized.
Good luck.
So where are they going to?
So currently the plan is to place the wall either down on the bike path or put it in the courtyard behind the band room.
Where does the school board think they ought to put it?
Those are the school boards.
Where do you think they ought to put it?
There's a location on the new campus. There's a map that's gone out, but I'll have to provide one the next meeting. We want to put it either next to the new parking lot, in between the driveway and parking lot, and a little grass path. It'd be very visible, and there's an option to provide additional benches nearby, or make a concrete path that leads directly to the mural, or to put it in the middle of the oak trees is another location we proposed. And that was just kind of outright ignored by the school board. And instead of, they didn't really give a reason as to why not, they just gave us the other option of we're putting it down by the bike path. And that was kind of their say, no elaboration. So that's up to the point where we are right now.
How's funding going?
We are, up to this point, the community has raised around $11,500.
Perfect.
And the school board has donated not to exceed $2,500 for moving the mural.
Good. Anything else, Lucas?
I believe that is it.
Great. Thank you very much. Department reports. Chief Sardi's not here. His stuff is in the weekly report. Mr. Bauer, anything to add?
I have nothing to add to my weekly report.
Thank you very much. New businesses, business licenses, Green Ridge Solar, Inc., Brian Butterfield, and Spacetel, LLC, Omar Al-Ghazali. I assume those have both been checked out by Chief Sardi. Need a motion to approve those two business licenses.
Are they going to be retail spots, or are they just contractors coming in?
So, I think you remind me what their names are real quick.
Green Ridge Solar.
Oh, it's right in front of me. Oh, so Green Ridge Solar is a contractor coming in to do a rooftop solar project on Ronald. And Spacetel is going to be a new storefront between the drugstore and the Dollar Tree.
Okay.
So that space, cell phone, did I say what it was? Cell phone.
Yes.
Cell phone.
Perfect.
What is it? Store
Cricket
and.
Great Wireless. Yeah.
Okay. Something. Yeah.
I make money.
Prepaid things.
I have a motion to approve.
Thank you.
I have a motion and a second to approve. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Same sign. Thank you very much. Mr. Bauer, we have the ordinance 21-692, 2020 legislative amendments to the zoning and subdivision ordinances and comprehensive plan. Mr. Bauer.
Thank you, Your Honor, members of council and members of the audience. Let's just get to the ordinance page.
We're gonna have it. We're gonna not. It's not in there. You have one that he has. so I at least I can.
Oh, you don't have the second page. There's two pages.
No,
you can.
Here's reading by title only, Mr. Bauer.
Yes. Ordinance number 21-692, an ordinance of the City of Winston, Oregon City Council adopting amendments to the City of Winston Zoning Ordinance, City of Winston Subdivision Ordinance, and Winston Comprehensive Plan. And so just to build on what Thomas presented tonight, the part that puts this in motion is the ordinance. And this is first reading tonight, so what you're approving is moving on to second reading at your next council meeting.
So do we have council action then?
Yes, you would have a motion and a second to move it to second reading.
Okay, so is that considered a staff report?
Yes.
Any comments from the audience? Okay, I'm looking for a motion to approve ordinance 21-692 and move it to the second reading.
I make a motion to accept ordinance number 21-692 to be moved to our next meeting.
I have a motion.
Second that.
I have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Thank you very much. Upcoming agenda items, the supplemental budget, second reading of ordinance 21-692, the SRO contract. How's that going in the House of Representatives in Salem? Has that been further discussed yet?
I have not seen it in, it hasn't got a committee reading date yet, so it may die, hopefully.
That'd be perfect. Douglas County Flow Ordinance, whatever that is. Non-agenda items from council.
Just one is a question. When are we going to reassign
Check copies in your packet, claims in excess of $500. Service line warranty update. Want to talk about that for a second, Mr. Bauer?
Did you get that in your...
I don't. Do you have it?
I don't have a packet.
I don't know why this is what happened here.
The service line warranty was the...
No, here's the ordinance. It got pushed behind the legislative amendment.
There you go.
That's right.
That's it right
okay.
there.
Okay. So we put this in your packet tonight to show you that our citizens are purchasing this warranty program, and they are out again to advertise to the community. So this will be an ongoing process that will be addressed to the community every year. So we have 72 residents enrolled, 149 policies, which means that they got a policy for sewer line and a policy for water. So they're kind of spelled out in the following numbers: plumbing and drainage, sewer, water, and policies per resident enrolled, so 2.7 policies per resident. So it hasn't been the hottest seller, but I believe that it will continue to pick up steam as people become more aware that it's out there and available to them, because that's one of the highest expenses you have as a homeowner, is if your service line goes out between either the meter, the water meter in your house, or the sewer line from your house to the city's main line. So what this does, this warranty policy protects you against that with a low deductible. So
who's this even here, Mark?
It's through a company in Pennsylvania, I believe.
Yeah, it's recommended through the National League of Cities.
And it's offered through the city?
It's offered. We are a partner by name only. We don't participate in any fund exchange or anything like that. One of the options was that the city could get a small percentage of the fee that is attached for the policy. City Council said, no, we don't want that. So that reduces the cost of the policy overall.
That amount was 60 cents.
Yeah,
there's no reason.
Okay, and I prescribed to it, and it's excellent.
So,
what's really interesting on it, for the prior owner of my house, I get it every month for him, I get it for my wife, I get it for me. In other words, I get three a month from them to sign up, which I've already had.
See,
I've got
nothing. That's because you didn't know. Well, yeah, well, thank you. Well, would you go ahead and sign up?
Sign
me
out,
please.
Pay for it.
Yeah, that could come out of your account.
I'd be happy to get you a copy of that.
Your Honor, it may be the post office box versus property address issue that you were describing.
That could
earlier.
Be.
Yeah.
Do we have applications here?
Do we have any applications here?
For what?
For the warranty program?
I don't, but I was going to say I would be happy to get you a copy of that. Would be what it looks like.
Please do.
And I'll get you all a copy of that.
Please
yes.
Please do, because I got to convince my wife.
I've got an application.
Okay.
Oh, my
God.
I
did
too.
Yeah.
Who did that?
Who is that? Alan?
This is Alan Hobson. I've got an application. Mm-hmm. I get one sent to me about three times now.
Oh, good. Yes. I mean,
they do two a year.
I have a question on that.
Hang on, hang on, hang on. Mr. Hobson.
Yes. I would like to ask, I have a step system for my sewer. Is my sewer line to the main line, is it, because I have a step system, is it covered through my step system fee or is it not?
I believe it is. It's covered through your step system charges, isn't it, Andy?
Yeah, from everything from the tank and then, from the tank out as we take
right.
over.
Yep. So you would okay. not need it for sewer.
You're covered.
But you don't
Thank
have
you.
But water you might be worth considering.
Yeah.
Don't get those two confused.
I'm thinking very seriously getting that water part of it.
Okay, anything else from the Census Bureau that said thank you for all the hard work you did to get them numbers? Announcements, Park Board, February 9th at 2, City Hall. Economic Development, February 10th at noon, City Hall. President's Day, February 15th, City Offices are closed. City Council, February 16th at 7, Urban Renewal, February 18th at 3.
Are we still going to have that second meeting since we're having one on Thursday?
That remains to be seen. It'll be after the next meeting if we do, so I think we need to maybe think about not doing that, but we'll see. The other thing, Park Board on February 9th, Councilor White has said that she will go ahead and host that meeting until we find someone to take her place.
We also have the joint meeting on February 8th, Monday, February 8th. At 6 o'clock.
What now? What's that for?
That's the joint City Council
Planning
Commission meeting to discuss potential zoning options for.
And that's going to be at.
That'll be here.
I thought we talked about it was going to be a large meeting. We do it up at.
This meeting, after speaking with Ms. Nichols about the process, she would prefer that just. She be present for this one, so she would then bring her family members in after she has the opportunity to brief them, which is they have a board of directors that oversees property management. So that's the way she would like to handle it. We actually meet with her on Wednesday. Mariah and I meet with her on Wednesday to start the discussion so that we can develop an agenda for the meeting. And then we'll hold the meeting on the 8th.
So we're on for the 7th then.
The 8th. What time?
8th at 6 o'clock for the joint meeting.
That's with the Planning Commission?
With the Planning Commission.
Okay.
very close.